Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hello, fellow Creative Control listeners. My name is Mac Cameron. I live in Toronto, and I have been listening to Creative Control with Vish Khanna since episode 119 that featured all five members of one of my favorite bands, Constantines. I listen backwards from there and then forwards, and I know it sounds, you know, over the top or cliche, but finding the show changed the course of my life. It inspired me to pursue a career in radio and to do what I can to support the arts in my community and across the country. So I give to Creative Control because I feel like I owe the show and Vish for helping me figure out what the hell to do with my life. Beyond that, I give to Creative Control because I think independent media, especially insightful, entertaining, thoughtful, and thorough independent media, is something that is worth paying for. What I appreciate about Creative Control is Vish's ability to treat Canadian artists, or any artists for that matter, with the seriousness and appreciation he would any other artist. His excellent rapport with people like Steve Albini and the members of Fugazi and Stephen Malkmus and others have earned him international appreciation. However, it's his trove of interviews with what I consider to be the most exciting generation of Canadian musicians, conducted out of genuine passion and interest, that makes this show so special. I think it is an archive of some really exciting music that is way, way underreported on and appreciated. That's why I contribute to Creative Control with Vish Khanna, and I hope you will do the same.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I am Vish's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do, and now he has me on the record saying that.
Richard Thompson is a legendary musician, songwriter, and singer based in the state of New Jersey. Originally from London, England, Thompson was a member of the band Fairport Convention, in which he helped spearhead a renewed interest in British folk traditions that revolutionized rock music in the late 1960s. In his subsequent work as a solo artist and in partnership with his ex-wife Linda, Richard Thompson continued to redefine what impassioned guitar playing, introspective lyricism, and commanding vocals could be. On April 6, 2021, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill published Thompson's first book, co-written with the late Scott Timberg. The beautiful memoir is entitled Beeswing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Richard and I connected recently for an extensive discussion about touring the United States in the late pandemic summer of 2021, his thoughts on older musicians speaking out about public health issues, how Fairport Convention and punk bands each dealt with reality in their respective work, his relationship with Bob Dylan as a fan and colleague, his time working with Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, his view of classic albums like I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight and Shoot Out the Lights, the standing of guitars in modern music, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find titles, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 634th episode of Creative Control, featuring the legendary, lovely, and talented Richard Thompson, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to talk to you, Vish.
Nice to talk to you. It's a great honor. First of all, where in the world are you?
I'm in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, USA.
Interesting. Now, from what I understand, based on my knowledge of your website, you are on tour right now. How is that going?
Well, it's going great. You know, I think for a lot of the audiences, this is the first time that they've been out for 18 months, 2 years. So they're excited to see some live music. I'm excited to play for them. You know, I'm just getting back into it myself. I've only done a few shows, you know, in the last 18 months myself. So it's actually great. It's wonderful to be back doing my job again.
I know from having read your book now a couple of times that live music, playing live music, the interaction, the connection with people is of the utmost importance to you. What was it like not being able to do that for these 18 months or so? And within that, what did you do? How did you occupy your time? And you know, were you able to connect with people in other ways?
It was a difficult time, but we were able to do some streaming performances. I probably did quite a lot, actually. And that was great to be able to have that connection with the audience and to be able to perform, even though you didn't really get an immediate response. That the response was, you know, in the chat column or something, people say, oh, you know, that was great, thank you. But it's not quite the same as having people applaud or, you know, you could see people enjoying the music. So that was a bit different. And I think everyone's had enough of the virtual performance by now. And everyone wants to get back to the live thing. What did I do? Well, what did I do? I did lots of things. I did a lot of writing, which was great. So I wrote and released a couple of EPs, six-track EPs. And I wrote the next band album and wrote some other things. So I was actually very busy. Plus, I had the advantage of having a home studio, so I could write stuff and then record it and release it. So, you know, it was a difficult time and a busy time at the same time. So, it was different.
That's remarkable. I've talked to artists who have told me various things about how they've managed this stillness, if you will. Some have said they've been so, I guess, depressed they haven't been able to write. You had the opposite. You were very prolific during this time, it sounds like.
Yeah. I thought it was important, you know, to really have a kind of an upbeat routine, you know, keep exercising every day, to keep working every day. I think at the end of 18 months, I was getting a bit of brain fog. I was feeling a bit ground down, if you like, by the you know, the routine of not being able to be on the road. You know, eventually I think it got me, but for the most part, I really tried to stay positive.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it possible? So you've played a few shows now. As we're speaking, you've played a handful of shows, like a few shows, right, on this tour? Is that right?
Yeah, we've probably done 5 or 6 by now, yes.
5 or 6, okay. Can you characterize the mood? I assume it's a lot of joy, you know, celebrations for being back together. Is there any reticence? Is there any, like, from you, you know, coming from the stage? By the way, I've neglected to ask, are you with a band right now or are you on your own?
This is just solo. It's still slightly impractical to be on the road with the band, but the mood has been really upbeat. You know, a great response when I walk on stage, because people are just thrilled to be there. They're thrilled to have that musical experience. You know, I think, you know, if there's any negativity, it's really before I get on stage, and it's more to do with what's the COVID code for the venue. You know, is the venue saying you have to wear a mask? Is the venue saying you have to be vaccinated? Yeah. So that there's kind of politics behind the scene that I don't necessarily see. And I don't have my own policy in that way. It's really venue by venue.
Right.
So there's a bit of that going on before people decide if they're going to go to the show, if they decide, you know, how they're going to be in the audience. But once the show starts rolling, I mean, it's really great. It's incredibly positive and upbeat. And I think people are just very excited to be there.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. I appreciate that you don't have your own policy. It's up to the venues. That seems in line with my perception of your way of thinking. There are people of your generation, public figures, musicians, as we're speaking, Eric Clapton's in the news, Van Morrison has been in the news, a bit older than you in some cases, yeah. or what have you. They've come out, they've made their statements, they've taken some flack. What do you make of what they've said? Not even, I'm not looking for your opinion necessarily, but the fact, like, is this a British thing? Is this an Irish thing to say, you know, screw it, screw everything. Everyone can make up their own mind. Do you relate to what they're saying in any way?
I can see where they're coming from, but I don't necessarily agree with them. And I think some people are almost taking a political stance. I don't think public health should ever be political.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I'm inclined to think, well, the health experts know what they're doing. They're giving the best advice they can. We should follow it. On the other hand, I mean, you know, I appreciate people want to have their personal freedom and all that, but when your freedom pinches on someone else's freedom, then there has to be some mitigation somewhere. So I'm just hoping that if we're all sensible and we get through this thing in the next few months and at the other side, is my hope.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you speaking on that. I ask partially because I've been so immersed in your book, Beeswing, that I feel like I've been, it's like a travelogue of sorts. I feel like I've been transported to England. I feel, having read your book a couple times, I feel a little more English. Does that resonate with you?
Well, I hope so. I think you know, it has to be my version of events. You know, it has to be that the world seen through my eyes at that time. You know, the time frame for the book is 67 to 75. You know, it was a very interesting time in the UK, especially for music. You know, it was a real coming together of different threads of style and technology. All these things kind of collided. And I was very fortunate to be really at the center of it, to be in London at that time, you know, to be a teenager growing up in London when the Beatles first appeared, and then to be a performing musician from 67 onwards, you know, playing with Pink Floyd and Hendrix and all these other people. You know, it was great to be really at the epicenter, or one of the epicenters of music at that time. And I suppose we never thought that generation would be influential, but it seems that, you know, people are still wearing their Led Zeppelin t-shirts and their Rolling Stones t-shirts. I mean, it's a strange thing, you know, but my grandkids are still listening to Sgt. Pepper and Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, it's a strange thing that the influence has lasted so long. So I just thought it was an important time to write about.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be careful not to spoil anything about the book for those who haven't read it yet. And I hope we entice people to read it. But you mentioned a few names there, Pink Floyd, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin. But these are people like you. It's not just that you were in the room with them. In a lot of cases, these were your actual peers, your colleagues, people you jammed with. That's right, isn't it?
That's true, yeah. Well, it was strange, you know, from going to see these bands, you know, when I was at school. And then just a couple of years later, we're actually on the bill with them. You know, we're actually playing alongside these people. Or we're in a club and, you know, Jimi Hendrix gets up and jams with us or something. You know, this was a very quick immersion into the music scene at that time, into sort of the psychedelic music scene. So it was very exciting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's magical. And you write about it so vividly that, I feel transported there. And I want to get into your motivations for writing this book in a moment. But first of all, just the title alone, you just mentioned that the book covers its subtitle is covering your songwriting life, I suppose, between 1967 and 1975. Having read the book, I know that it covers more than just that. Beeswing is a song you released in 1994. Mm-hmm. It's also a name that I believe you've employed for your songwriting publishing. So I'm just curious. I just want to home in on that. What is the significance of Beeswing as a phrase to you to title this book Beeswing when the song in question didn't even emerge for around 20 more years after, you know, 1975? I'm just curious. Why does that phrase stand out for you?
Beeswing is a tiny little village in Scotland, very close to where my family came from. So I've always had that name in my head. And when I wrote the song in, as you say, in the 90s, it just seemed to me to encapsulate some of the spirit of the 60s. You know, people were kind of dropping out of society. A lot of people I knew at school didn't kind of fulfill their academic ambitions. They really just dropped out and became drug dealers and God knows what, and kind of went into an alternative lifestyle. And it just seemed to be a time for that. And I think the song Beeswing talks about, if you like, voluntary and involuntary falling through the safety net of society.
Yeah.
And I think that was a real 60s thing. Certainly, it struck me that way. And that seemed to be a reflection of the kind of people I knew and the kind of society that I moved in, with people really looking for something else. And it was, it was a sociological thing, it was a political thing, and it was a spiritual thing as well. There was a lot of spiritual seeking at that time.
Yeah.
Some of it was, you know, questionable, but some of it, I think there was real value in it.
Did you, and through the course of this book, I'm sure you've had an opportunity to reflect upon who you were in this time frame, obviously. Are you surprised by just how much of, an outsider you seem to be and want to be?
From what I can understand, reading about, you know, the lives of, you know, poets and filmmakers and authors and everything, I mean, they're all outsiders.
Yeah.
You know, they're all slightly removed from society. They're just on the edge of it and they're looking inwards. And I think that's the only way you really have perspective on it, is to almost feel yourself that like a bit of an alien, you know, you're not totally involved in that way. You know, there's a part of you that can hold back and can comment on what you see and what you feel. I think that's very important to be an outsider.
Do you still feel like an outsider?
I do, yeah. yeah, I still feel that I don't fit. I never felt like I fitted anywhere, really. Yeah. And maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah. No, I can appreciate that. So let's get into the why now. What motivated you to write Beeswing at this point in your life? I was alluding to the pandemic earlier, and I know that the stillness has prompted people to reflect, maybe take on projects just like this one. But I gather just from the timeline that that's not the case for you. It wasn't that you were like, well, I've got nothing else to do. I might as well write about my life. When did you start writing this book? And why did you start writing this book?
Well, I probably started a good year before the pandemic kicked in. So it was basically written and we was really into the editing process during the pandemic. So that can take a while, you know, going backwards and forwards with editors. Why did I write it? it seemed like an interesting thing to do. As I said, I mean, people do ask me about that time period. And people have said, you know, why don't you write a book and why don't you do it about this time? And I think as a first attempt at a book, I think this was absolutely the time period to choose because it was very condensed. A lot happened in that short space of time. And it was a time when, you know, I and the band, you know, Fairport, were doing stuff for the first time. You know, so we're playing a show in Bradford or wherever, or Manchester, and it's the first time that we've been there. So your recollections are very vivid of that first time. Once you've done it the fifth time, the sixth time, the tenth time, there's less to write about.
Right.
But everything was fresh. You know, going to America was fresh. So there's all this fresh stuff hitting you all the time. Like every day there's a new experience. So, you know, it's great to write about that stuff. And you know, I think also it just is not a terrible thing to contribute yet another view of the 60s into the 70s because it was such a fertile time. You know, it's almost like you need more social history as well as just straight, but you know, straightforward history. You need more people's accounts of what that was like and how it went down.
Are there particular misconceptions about that time, that place, that were on your mind that you thought, you know, people think it was this? I kind of, as an eyewitness, as a participant, I can kind of dispel some of these misconceptions. I can clarify some things. Was any of that swimming around in your head as you talked about yourself and your life and Fairport Convention and the sort of scene at the time? Was that on your mind at all?
I wasn't really thinking about it at the time. In retrospect, I can say that probably the most standout thing that was probably the lack of money. You know, people think, you know, if you're a musician, you must be rolling in money. And very few actually were. I think we were mostly impoverished, really. You know, we were living hand to mouth pretty much. Yeah. And, you know, Fairport were on, you know, a very minimal weekly wage. There were lots of bands that weren't on a wage at all, and they were poorer than we were. Mm-hmm. People lived in squats, you know, that they lived in like terrible housing situations. But, you know, once they got on stage, you know, that they looked, you know, suitably, you know, glamorous and iconic, but it was a tough grind, and it took another year or two before bands like, you know, Pink Floyd and The Who, you know, became stadium bands, you know, but became huge and extremely rich. In 1967, everybody was basically hand to mouth.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned this because your book, because of the era you cover, your book ends as punk in England is gestating. And in the book, you mention the Sex Pistols and the Damned releasing singles. And I feel like in a brief way, you suggest that it was quite invigorating to hear this kind of music. Were you a fan of those types of bands and what they were talking about in terms of what it was like to actually live in England at the time?
I thought it was a breath of fresh air. I think, you know, as we went further into the 70s, you know, 73, 74, 75, it was glam rock, it was metal, and it was prog rock, and none of which I really cared for. Yeah. And I thought, you know, rock and roll is just recycling, or it's becoming pretentious, or it's becoming bombastic. You know, the old values have gone away. You know, what's going on? Well, what am I going to do? I mean, that was my big question. You know, where do I fit into the evolving music scene, and what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And then the punks came along, you know, the Sex Pistols, the Buzzcocks, who were a great band. And I thought, this is the energy that we need. You know, this is getting back to what rock and roll does best, which is basically, you know, three chords and, you know, bass, drum, guitar. That's all you need. It's like the Elvis Sun sessions.
Yeah.
You know, that's real rock and roll. Buddy Holly, that's real rock and roll. And you know, I saw punk as really getting back to that kind of route, to you know, 1955, 56 version of rock and roll. And I thought, this is great. This shows me what I should be doing. I should be getting back to the same basic idea and not even flirt with things like prog rock or, you know, or metal or glam rock or any of that stuff. You know, that's another world now.
Yeah.
That I shall have nothing to do with. You know, I should go back to the roots of it all.
You're talking about punk on an aesthetic level, and you're kind of, I think you're homing in on sort of its sonic qualities. Mm. But one of the things that has always resonated with me about punk is that it seemed to reflect reality. You mentioned that when Fairport was going, in the early days in particular, you were living in poverty, and that's reflected in this book. Do you feel like, and when I listen to Fairport, it feels whimsical. It feels sort of timeless, whereas punk was like, this is now. This is what's happening now. Do you feel, and I'm not trying to, Fairport is obviously, it's a long legacy. Every record was different. Do you feel like Fairport reflected reality in a way that, or was it an idealized reality, peace, love, you know, a lot of the 60s ideals? Or did you feel like Fairport actually was reflecting the grind that you describe and reality for so many people from England and in that area?
I don't think that we did particularly reflect that kind of reality. I think, you know, Fairport's mission, if you like, was to reconnect popular music, you know, rock music with, you know, British traditions. And some of those were industrial, and some were pastoral.
Yeah.
And so I think in Fairport you find a lot of you know pastoral music, a kind of an Edwardian Victorian, pre-Victorian, you know, Georgian worldview, and that was really just a byproduct of us taking old songs and trying to revive them.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have done more industrial gritty songs, of which there were plenty. for some reason, but we didn't really choose those. But you know, I think perhaps we should have chosen more of that kind of stuff, you know, because it was important and politically would have been more more apt, really, for Fairport to do that stuff. So if I have to apologize for Fairport in any sense, then I'd apologize for being a bit too bucolic, a bit too pastoral in our music choices. But you know, that wasn't really who we were. We were just trying to make this connection.
Well, first of all, I was not trying to provoke an apology. Fairport Convention is a wonderful, wonderful entity, hugely influential. I talk to so many young artists who still cite Fairport as a massive influence, and it's very significant. Mm. You did leave the band, I think, for creative differences. I mean, that's what my vibe is from reading your book. Is that fair? It just was going in a place that you didn't feel like was you. Is that right?
I love creative differences. It covers a multitude of sins, really. It's a great catch-all phrase. I think musical differences. I think I was also just burned out. I've been in bands since I was 11, really, 11 or 12 years old.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to do something on my own. I wanted to concentrate on writing on my own and kind of being my own boss for a while, really. So I think it was burnout. I think also... the effects of the accident that we had that killed our drummer.
Yeah.
I think we were all traumatized for that for a couple of years, and we weren't making good decisions. And I made a bad decision. I don't know.
Well, I mean, at the time, the band was, I think, based on your telling, it was seemingly coming into its own. However, the live show was a little erratic, and some members, I don't know, they were just playing too fast or not on the same team, on the same page. You were known as a band that did a lot of covers initially, particularly of, I think at the time, obscure Bob Dylan songs, among others. And
yeah.
And then there was this movement towards getting back to that, just as you thought the band was finally finding its creative voice. Have I encapsulated that well enough for you?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Fairport went through stages. You know, we did, as you say, we started out as a covers band. But we like to do, you know, non-obvious covers. So if we were going to do a Dylan song, well, we'd find the most obscure Dylan song that we could. We love the singer-songwriters. We were very early into Joni Mitchell, into Leonard Cohen, into Richard Farina. And then, you know, we started to evolve as writers, and so we wanted to be performing the songs that we had written ourselves. And then we wanted to be reconnecting with British folk traditions. And so that became our focus. And then probably at the point where I left the band, I was thinking, well, you know, we should be writing more and playing less traditional music. So I think I wanted the freedom to do that at that point.
Yeah. Well, where do you see the influence of the music you made with Fairport Convention and on your own from the era covered in the book? Where do you see the influence of your work the most? Do you see it in contemporary music? Did you see it in the immediate aftermath or as the band was existing? Or I'm just wondering if you can characterize that. Like I say, I talk to lots of people who talk about you and Fairport, and Richard, if I may, you in particular. There's a lot of love and admiration for you and the work you've done on your own. Do you have a sense of that? Do you see your influence and in all the work you've done? Do you see it in contemporary music?
Absolutely not. I really don't. I wouldn't have a clue. I mean, I wouldn't recognize it if you kind of pointed me at it. I just wouldn't know.
That's fascinating. So, that's fascinating.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No. It's yeah. Fascinating. I mean, there are people in my sort of friend group milieu, if you will, who see like, I want to see the Bright Lights Tonight, the record you made with Linda Thompson, as like a forebearer to punk, you know, as like the way forward, and Shoot Out the Lights as well. Like these particular records, by the way, how do you feel about, I invoke those two because for some strange reason, I suppose, beyond the fact that they're genius records, are you aware of that? There's a certain mystique around those two records of yours in particular?
Well, I mean, I think they're good records. I think Bright Lights is a really good record, and I listen to it occasionally and think, wow, that really worked.
Yeah.
You know, you can go in the studio and you can have the best intentions and think you've got the best collection of songs, and, you know, you make the record and this goes wrong and that goes wrong, and you can't quite crack this song, and maybe you got the wrong drummer for the film. You know, the things can just conspire against you making a good record, and that does happen quite a lot. With Bright Light, everything just went so well. You know, everything that we recorded worked. We got 3 days. You know, it cost, I think, £2,500 at the time. Even at the time, that was like peanuts. Mm-hmm. To me, it still sounds really good, you know. So that was lucky. I Shoot Out the Lights, I have issues with the way it sounds, but I think it's a great collection of songs, and I still perform many of those songs to this day. So if people, you know, like those records, then I'm very happy about that. I think that's great.
Okay, but you're not hearing it per se. You're not hearing from people directly that, you know, oh my God, like if it wasn't, or reading about it. Like I know a friend of mine, someone I admire, Will Oldham, massive fan of yours. And the more people dig into your catalog, I think, fans of Will's, I mean, as Bonnie Prince Billy or whatever, the more you kind of, if you're a fan of Will's and then you listen to your catalog, you're like, oh, this is maybe where Will is coming from. Are you aware of him? Are you aware of people like him who have kind of cited your work?
I see. Well, I know him. He did some duet stuff with my daughter, Cammie. So I know him. I've met him. Seems like a nice guy. I wouldn't know if there's any influence there whatsoever. I really wouldn't. Couldn't tell you.
Okay. So you kind of exist. It's because you're an outsider, Richard. I think that's what it is. You live outside of the praise, even, it seems.
I suppose so. But plus, you know, I'm kind of busy. I haven't got time to think about who's influenced who or all that sort of stuff. You know, I just have to get on with what I'm doing, and it takes most of my time.
Yeah, fair enough. Speaking of influences, we both mentioned Bob Dylan. I saw you perform in Toronto on the 2013 Americanorama tour.
Oh.
And for those who don't know, it was wonderful. For me, I'll just let people know. So that tour, or that show that I saw anyway, featured you, Richard. It featured Wilco, My Morning Jacket, and Bob Dylan. And then there was a jam session at the end, which the people in Wilco had told me I'd done an interview with some of them before the show. And they said, yeah, none of us have interacted with Dylan at all. And then I saw I saw this gathering happen on stage, and I understood that was the first time. And there were some songs performed, and it was wonderful. Do you have fond memories of that tour or even that show in Toronto in particular?
It was a strange tour. You know, we were opening, you know, the whole thing. So we were going on at 5:30 p.m. when, you know, a quarter of the audience had turned up at that point. So that was a little strange, you know, playing in these, you know, minor league baseball stadiums to a small audience. But it was fun. And it was great hanging out with Wilco. You know, I did lots of jamming with Wilco. That was a lot of fun. I met Dylan, which was lovely. I've met him before, but we had a nice conversation on that tour. That was lovely. And it was great, yeah. And I got paid as well, so it was fantastic.
Have you only met him on a couple of occasions, Mr. Dylan?
Yeah, two times, yeah.
Okay, and I know that he appears in the book briefly at a show, but things don't go well, as I recall. He slips out of the room. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I think I was playing with Sandy. If you don't know Sandy Denny, then she's was a wonderful British singer-songwriter. And we were playing New York. I think it was the Bottom Line. No, it wasn't the Bottom Line. Which one was it? Anyway, I forget where we were. And, you know, the stage manager, you know, says to me, oh, by the way, Dylan's in the audience this evening. And I said, well, okay, don't tell Sandy. But, of course, he told Sandy, who just went to pieces, basically. Yeah. Because, you know, she loved Dylan. I've never seen her so nervous in my life. So she kind of stumbled through the set and played way below her best. And I was hoping to say hello to Bob at the end of the show, but he kind of slipped quietly away, right, as he should, because he was a well-known face around the village at that time. So I'm sure he didn't want to be seen necessarily.
Well, it's nice to hear you've interacted with him before. I gather you're still a fan of his.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, and he's a great example, I think, to all of us to keep on going. You know, I mean, the guy's 80 years old. He just wrote a couple of fantastic songs, I hope I can do the same. And when I hit that kind of milestone.
Yeah, as we're speaking, I just last night finished writing my review of the new bootleg series that covers sort of the 80s, 80 to 85. So he's swimming around. Just so you know, Richard, I love Bob Dylan. I've seen him like 40 times or something since. I love him, and I wrote a master's thesis about him. Like I'm not nuts. I just want to clarify that as well. I'm not. I love him, but I also am. I study, and I just think he's great. So I appreciate that you had this connection with him as well, and you did end up working with Jeff Tweedy after that on a record. Was that because of that tour? Is that where you met?
I think it was. No, that's not true. I think we did a show with Wilco a long time ago. When they were quite a new band, we did a co-bill with Wilco at the Beacon in New York, and we met them then. And I've kind of seen them here and there over the years. But I mean, I really like the idea of Jeff producing something. He did such a great job on the Mavis Staples record, that first one that he produced, and I thought, well, that's great. If he can do that for Mavis, perhaps he can do something for me as well. And I really enjoyed working with him. And he's a lovely guy. I really love hanging out with him, and he has great ideas and great stories, just an all round good guy.
Yeah, he's a lovely fellow. I've interacted with him a few times, so I agree, and I'm a fan of his as well. You invoked Sandy Denny there, a wondrous vocalist, and it brings to mind the fact that I feel like, you know, someone like you writes a memoir about their life, and obviously they are going to share their story. But one of the generous aspects of your book to me is that you're sort of telling other people's stories. You are bringing to mind, back to mind, people that you've lost, friends, colleagues. Was that, did you have a sense of responsibility in that regard? Like, this isn't just about me, it's about these people in my life and how significant they were to music and the world at large. Someone needs to tell this story. Was that on your mind at all?
I think, you know, my experience of moving through life was who I was moving through life with, you know, who was around me, really. You know, it's not all kind of egotistical, you know, self-obsession or self-reflection, you know, as you grow through life. You really are very influenced and interacting all the time with other people. And Sandy was someone very important in my life, you know, as were, you know, Nick Drake and John Martin, you know, stablemates, you know, people who were on the same label, people who you recorded with, people you had the same management, the same agency. You know, they're, you know, very, very important people in your life with whom you spend a lot of time. You know, if you're on the road with someone, being on the road with Sandy or with Ian Matthews, you know, there's a lot of downtime where you're just chatting.
Yeah.
Inevitably, you know, for a month or 2 months on end, you know, you're on some tour, and you're on planes together. You're in buses together. You're hanging out backstage together. You know, so that there's always, you know, a lot of your life is lived with other people, and it's important to reflect that.
Yeah. Well, in reflecting upon your life and the life you've shared with others, with this book. I would assume you can't help but learn something about yourself as well. I mean, this is a foundational period that you're covering. Mm. Is there anything in particular that you feel like you learned about yourself in completing this project and reflecting upon it now that it's out in the world? I mean, I know that once you release something like this, even to your publisher, you might have that little sense of release of like, oh my God, I've just told people stories I've been keeping to myself for most of my life. Do you have a sense of that release? And within what I was saying at the beginning, do you feel like you learned something profound about yourself?
Well, I think absolutely, yeah. I mean, a sense of release, yes. A sense of trepidation as well, because you really are exposing yourself. Sometimes even more than you would do in a song. You know, a song is a naked thing.
Yeah.
And getting up on stage, like as a solo artist, for instance, it is a very naked thing. And if you also wrote the song that you're singing, then that's twice as naked, you know. But even that doesn't compare to writing, you know, an autobiography where you really, really are bearing your soul. And inevitably, that's a little scary because you're throwing it out there, and people, you know, really can come up to you and say, "Did you really do that? Or is that how you feel?" And blah blah blah. And or you know, it exposes you to endless questions. First of all, I suppose it's a kind of a cathartic thing to having written it and say, okay, that's that, you know, I've done that. And then think, well, you know, do I do volume two? Do I move on from there? Or should I just say that's enough and I'll go back to being a songwriter? I haven't quite answered that question yet. I don't know.
Well, it's curious you invoke that because in the epilogue of the book, you write, "The attic is empty now," which to me suggests we may not see further volumes beyond the one you cover in this era. Am I misreading that? When you say the attic is empty now, that's the release part. I think, yeah. You know, I've got this out of my system. But does that also intimate maybe you don't have to talk beyond this or right beyond this?
Well, there is the basement, of course.
There's other rooms. There's other rooms to explore, yes.
Yes, I mean... The attic is empty. The basement is jammed with stuff I've never looked at all. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, certainly when I was writing this, I was not intending to write anything else. I wasn't thinking this is the first of a series. I just thought this is a good time period to cover, and I'll do this, and then I see what I'll do. I mean, I would like to write something else, but it might not be autobiographical. I mean, I could write something that's fiction. I could write something that's about music. So we'll see. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I don't want to pin you to anything. Speaking of soul-bearing, I'm curious about the dream section of this book, which surprised me. At the end of this book, we encounter a section where you just recount some dreams that you've alluded to earlier in the book.
Hmm.
What prompted that? What prompted you to flesh out those dreams and include them separately at the end?
I think that my original intention was to weave them through the body of the book, to have them appear where they are kind of relevant. So, you know, if I'm talking about Keith Richard, then the dream about Keith Richard is in the same place. My editors thought it really interrupted the flow of the narrative, and they wanted to ditch them all together.
Hmm.
And I said, well, you know, can we put them as an appendix? So they said, yes, that's fine. So that's really the way we ended up. Perhaps it would have been better to have had them in the body of the text, but it might have been confusing for people. but to me, yeah, you know, it would have been more like the real experience of the 60s and 70s was, which is kind of partly hallucinatory, you know. So you're never quite sure what was real and what wasn't real.
Yeah.
And so to drift from, you know, a realistic narrative into a dream for me would have been perfect because that was really what life was like at that time.
Are you someone who generally keeps a journal or a diary and documents such things?
I wish I had. That would have saved me a lot of trouble if I had kept a really good journal for all the time. I mean, the dreams I remember because they're so vivid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there are certain dreams that are just like reality anyway. So I remember them so well. I didn't have to write those down. I might have tidied up the dialogue a little bit, but that's about all.
I assume we may have gotten glimpses into other dreams of yours via your songs. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think another reason I wanted to put the dreams is because I think if a dream is subconscious, a song is certainly semi-conscious. So you're kind of feeding into the same area. You know, your creativity is just like really one step away from the subconscious sometimes.
Yeah.
So I thought that it would be instructive, if you like, for the reader to see the other world going on, that creative world. Because, it's hard to say, this is how I wrote this song. This is the process I went through. But it's easy to show a dream and say, look, the song is just a millimeter removed from sleep. Process.
Right.
So that was really my intention with it, was to just show, where the creativity comes from, if you like.
Well, it's very entertaining, so I'm happy with the decision were included. Yeah, very, very entertaining. I enjoyed them. It was surprising, but I enjoyed them. It was like a whole other universe opened up, and then it was done. There are not that many dreams, but I will say, I wish there were more. I would love to read just about some of your dreams. They seem very vivid and fascinating.
Yeah, in one sense, I thought, well, to hell with this. Ditch the book. I'll just do a book of dreams, and that'll be enough. But the trouble with dreams is that they do become repetitive.
Yeah.
And if I'd included more, then it'd just be a bit more of the same as one's dark psyche kind of bubbles up to the surface. The same demons appear again and again. So perhaps it was judicious to stop where I stopped.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful book. You alluded to the fact that you have released a few EPs recently, and recently, I believe you made the announcement that one of them, Serpent's Tears, is now available. I think across streaming services. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's also available now on actual CD, because I know some people are allergic to digital forms and downloads, but we now have the actual CD of the last two EPs that were released.
Okay.
And if you come to a show, you can buy them from our merchandise table, and you can buy them from my website as well.
Now, I just want to get at these a little bit. What prompted the notion of releasing these things as EPs as opposed to a record? And within that, I've been focused quite a bit on Serpent's Tears in the lead up to this conversation, so I've been thinking about it a little bit. So I'm just wondering about maybe when you wrote these songs. I've been talking to lots of people who have been writing during the pandemic about the pandemic, so to speak, and issues of loneliness, isolation, lack of connection, these sorts of things. So I guess, the two questions are, why EPs as opposed to maybe an LP? And if you can characterize from your perspective what inspired these songs or what they might be supposedly about, I'd love to hear that too. Can you speak to those things?
I can try. Well, first of all, why EPs? I think EPs, just because that seemed to be the number of songs that I had on hand at a time. And I thought, well, I don't want to make a CD because a CD seems too much like a statement. And attracts too much attention, and will get reviewed, etc. And it's also something that perhaps I should do with a record company as opposed to just putting it out myself. So I thought an EP was just a way around that, really. And the original idea was, I just put it up on Bandcamp. It was also to earn money, frankly, because I was 18 months without work the coffers were getting low. Couple of pieces, and I think I wrote all the songs during lockdown. I didn't want to write songs about lockdown. That just seemed to me really tedious and boring. Maybe the songs reflect what lockdown was like, what lockdown was about. I'm sure that's in there somewhere, but it certainly wasn't the obvious theme of the songs. The theme of the songs are all over the place. I mean, it's really absolutely here, there, and everywhere. So make of that what you will, I think it makes a good LP when you put Serpent's Tears and Bloody Noses, which is the one before, together. You put those two together, and it's an interesting acoustic home recording, which is what it sounds like. I'm everything. My partner Zara sings a little bit as well, which is nice, and basically I'm playing, you know, percussion, bass, you know, anything I can get my hands on.
Yeah.
But it's mostly just acoustic.
Well, there are some themes of loss, and when I think of the Big Love scene, or when the Saints rise out of their graves, or Widows Walk, there's loss there. There's loss of people, there's loss of relationships. I couldn't help but wonder if these were inspired by stories you've read about others, maybe even what they've been going through, some personal experiences, I don't know. But that's where my mind kind of went. Like, there's a lot of death and loss in the air these days. So I just wondered if you were inspired or influenced by that, or experienced something even.
Yeah, I think losing friends, I mean, not necessarily, you know, to COVID, but just losing old friends. I mean, I've lost a couple in the last few years, and it's devastating, you know. And when you get to my age, I mean, I'm into my 70s, and, you know, it happens to you, you know. And if you know, if you don't drop dead, then other people do, and it's very disturbing. So there is that sense of loss, you know. I just went through a long and difficult divorce. That's another kind of loss, you know, that right in there. So it's been a turbulent time for me anyway, and lots of subject matter anyway to write about.
Yeah, I'm very sorry for your loss and hardship. It's none of my business per se, but I appreciate you sharing that's maybe where your emotional state is at, and I appreciate it. And yeah, I wish you the best going forward. I think there are going to be some guitar people who are going to be upset with me at this point for not asking you more about guitar. So I will, I'm sure you get asked a lot of questions about your guitar playing. All I really wonder, though, we're in a weird age of, for me anyway, as someone who follows music, about the kind of prominence of guitar music these days. It seems to be, I can't figure it out. It seemed to be waning. People seem to be like, guitars, that's old fashioned. And now it seems to be coming back in vogue. Do you have any thoughts on the guitar? I know it's all you know. I know you're a busy fellow and you keep yourself busy. You don't maybe pay attention to what other people are talking about. That's my sense from this conversation. But is your relationship with the guitar changed at all for yourself in recent years, or at all since you first picked it up?
Not really. I do what I do, and it's a very close personal relationship that I have with my instruments, and that hasn't really changed. It's certainly evolved, but it hasn't really changed. Why is the guitar popular? I thought probably the 70s that the guitar was probably on the way out, you know, when synthesizers came in, and that then you had kind of synth pop in the 80s, and I thought, well, you know, this is the death surely of the guitar. And I wasn't sorry about that, you know, really. I thought, well, you know, it's become so cliched, especially the electric guitar, and I thought, well, I'll just go back to playing acoustic, I'll go back to playing in folk clubs, you know, I'll find a living somehow, you know, I'll concentrate more on being a songwriter.
Yeah.
But then the guitar keeps coming back, you know. It's just one of those things that you know, the guitar is a portable instrument.
Yeah.
You can carry it around with you. You can take it out at a party, you know, and play for people. You know, you can play in your hotel room. You can take it camping. You know, it's a very portable thing. And I think that has really helped to maintain its popularity.
Yeah.
The equivalent, you know, for keyboard players is the accordion. And it's hard to look sexy playing the accordion, let's face it. But you can just about look sexy playing the guitar.
Okay, so, fair enough.
So I think, you know, for that reason, you know, the guitar has remained popular. I think they sell something like 3 million acoustic guitars a year in America.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of instruments.
Yeah, no, it's...
That's huge. I think it's just that the thing of it's not that hard to play at a basic level. You know, it has that simplicity to it. And you know, you can make homemade music with it. And then you can plug it in and rock out, you know. So, and it seems that plugging it in and rocking out has maintained its allure somehow through the years, through the decades. I'm waiting for some big music revolution to happen where suddenly, you know, it's all about the French horn, or it's all about the, you know, the classical harp or something. You know, like people are rushing to shops to buy trombones. So, I mean, it's got to happen at some point.
Yeah, it'll be just apps. It'll all just be apps at some point, I'm sure. You won't even have to have anything.
Oh, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts on that. Now, you had alluded to the fact that you've been quite prolific over the last 18 months working on things. I often wrap these conversations up by asking people what's next. I'm not exactly sure where to begin, given the litany of things you mentioned. What is kind of next for you, Richard? You're on this tour as we're speaking. Beyond that, do you have plans for releases of any sort?
Yeah. Well, I've got this tour, then I've got another UK tour, then I've got another US tour. Then there's a gap where maybe I can get in the studio and record with my band. So I've got material written for the band. I'd love to go in and do that. That would be fantastic. And I'm not thinking too much beyond that at the moment because everything is so backed up. Hmm. My 2022 is all the stuff that I had to move from this year. So, you know, my diary is crammed with shows for next year. Hmm. So it's going to be, you know, how to fit stuff in, really. But that's the next recording plan anyway. Hopefully do something with my band.
You've been around a while. You've seen lots of things. I assume you have a sense of how things can play out based on the way we're all behaving. Do you, in your heart, feel like we're heading back to any semblance of normalcy sometime soon? I know you have to maybe feel that way as a musician who wants to tour, but do you feel like that's going to happen in 2022? Is that going to be a normal year?
I think it has to. Hmm. But I think people are fried with lockdowns. But at some point, enough people get vaccinated and then you say, okay, that's it. That, you know, if you want to mask up for the rest of your life, that's fine. If you want to just get on with life and trust your immune system, that's fine too. I think 2022 will be normal, really. Oh, I do.
Okay. Well, we'll see. I'm going to hold you to this. This is on the record, by the way. We're all going to find out if you're right.
Okay. Okay. Blame me.
Richard, if people want to learn more about you, your music, your work, I'm hoping you can tell us where to go in terms of, you know, an online destination. I will also say that this beautiful new book, Beeswing, is out via Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, which is a division of Workman Publishing. And you can learn more about that at algonquin.com. In terms of you and your other pursuits, is there a place you'd like to send them? And a website, social media, these sorts of things?
Yeah, sure. My website is richardthompson-music.com. And you can find me under my own name on Facebook. I'm sure I'm on Instagram and all the other ones as well, but I never look at those. I'm easy to find.
You don't engage with any of your social media, Twitter, anything like that?
Twitter, no. The only one I look at is Facebook, really.
Oh, okay.
And even then, I don't spend too much time on that.
Okay, fair enough. Now, if there's a song, perhaps from one of the recent EPs that we can go out on for people, I wonder if you're up for that, Richard, do you mind choosing one and also maybe telling us why it came to mind?
Okay, well, there's a song called The Fortress, which, you know, it's a home recording. But I like the song, and the song, I think, is about arrogance. It's about, you know, someone who thinks they're great, but you know, the world crumbles beneath them, and they become utterly deflated and defeated by life. You know, that's it. It's not an original idea, but I think it's a good song.
Was it inspired by anyone in particular?
Ooh, I wouldn't like to say.
You wouldn't like to say. You're leaving us hanging here. Okay. Is this
afraid,
from...
Afraid so.
It's fair. Leave us hanging. Why not? I think that's fair. Okay, so we'll play... it's from the Bloody Noses EP. This is The Fortress by the legendary and gracious Richard Thompson. Richard, this was a tremendous pleasure for me, a deep honor. I thank you for your time, and I hope we speak again someday, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you, Vish. Thank you so much for the interview. Great pleasure. Thank you.
One day, the ceiling falls in on you. You're more than perfect world. I suddenly come unglued. There you are. Trust is so much dust. The friends you thought you knew have all betrayed your trust. There you are. Head over heels,
your life is up the spout, and there you are. One day, nothing makes sense at all. Your career slow suicide. Your brain has hit the after all. You know John Wayne and you know Gunslinger. You thought you had the whole world wrapped around your finger. You always said it was the song and not the singer. After all, you said you're on neck. You thought that that was clever. Your head's just
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
True honor and thrill to get to speak to Richard Thompson on this show. You know, as I was editing that episode, I feel like I screwed some stuff up. I mean, he mentions he has this conversation with Bob Dylan, and I don't know, sometimes the line between nosy and curious, I try not to blur it too much. I should have just said, well, what'd you guys talk about? But, you know, then I felt if he wanted to talk about it, he'd tell me. Maybe he's saving it for his next book, too. Why is he going to waste that anecdote on me, you know? Anyway, otherwise, very happy, and I'm very thankful and grateful to you, Richard Thompson, for appearing on this, the 634th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at @vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter or on Instagram at @vishkhanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this show. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content, and if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please message me on Patreon and I'll get you one just as soon as is humanly possible and while supplies last. I just sent one to Whitehorse in the Yukon Territory, so if that was bound for you, look out, it's on its way. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place special orders at by their website, of course, blackbird.ca. Well, maybe you want to order some Richard Thompson records. I don't know. Blackbird.ca for more info. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. As always, my dear friend Jim Guthrie loans me some music that he made that I can use on this show, and I urge you all to visit his website, jimguthrie.org, to learn more about Jim and his vast and impressive universe of song. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with the great Richard Thompson. If you're new to the show, welcome. If you're a veteran of the show, thanks for sticking around. Thanks for subscribing to the podcast and maybe telling your friends about the show and suggesting maybe they do the same. Subscribe to the show, follow the show, whatever, and spread the word about it. Otherwise, I'll be back with you very soon. I hope you're doing all right and not stressed out like I am all the time because your kids are in school and there's a pandemic. It'll be fine, I hope. Anyway, talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.